And welcome to Thursday Night Talk. Tonight, Sharon Fennell is our host on the next edition of On the Line. We welcome your contributions. Give us a call when Sharon opens the phone lines at 826-4805, at 800-640-5911, and to our text line at 492-KHSU.
Thank you very much, Michael. This is Sharon, and I call my Thursday night slot On the Line. Our topic for the next 90 minutes will focus on what so many of us are talking about and trying to wrap our heads around, namely sexual harassment. What constitutes sexual harassment or sexualized violence? I'd like us to explore the sociological, psychological, and cultural dynamics of this timeless matter. Is this about misogyny as pathology? How about hashtag Me Too? Is this a man's problem? Is our culture to blame? How are women of color and other marginalized people affected? Why now? Degrees of offense. Does it matter? Due process. How do we shift the focus to the strength that we have, that we can live healthy lives? Can we use a restorative justice model moving forward? These are just a few of the areas we will discuss, and by all means, feel free to jump in with your thoughts and insights after I cover some ground with my guest for the next 90 minutes, Dr. Melinda Myers. Dr. Myers comes to us with over two decades of teaching students at Humboldt State University. Dr. Myers was a major collaborator in creating Humboldt State University's Critical Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program and the Queer Studies minor. In addition, Dr. Myers has worked to successfully reduce the achievement gap for underrepresented students in introduction to psychology classes at Humboldt. To that end, she received the 2016-2017 Department of Psychology Excellence in Teaching Award. Dr. Myers is a licensed clinical psychologist and is the owner of Good Relations, a sex-positive boutique in Old Town Eureka, and a KHSU underwriter. Please let me take a minute before we begin our discussion to suggest, if there are young ones in earshot, parental discretion is advised. In addition, although Dr. Myers is a licensed clinical psychologist, she is not here to engage in on-air therapy. And having said that, both Dr. Myers and I know that therapy can truly help those affected by sexualized violence. Dr. Myers, thank you so much for being here on KHSU this evening. You and I go way back, so can I call you Melinda from this point?
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me, Sharon. I'm happy to be here.
You're welcome. How has teaching been for you all these years at Humboldt State?
It's been remarkable. I've had between 10 and 15,000 students, and I've taught 19 different courses. Most of them many, many times. And today was my last day, and I'm going to miss it terribly, but it's time to do some other things in my life.
Wow.
So it's been incredible. It's been my great honor, for sure.
Wow. Was it a difficult decision to, stop now, or?
Yes, it was. Mm. I've been thinking about it for some time. Mm-hmm. You and I have, it's been a long time since we've seen our younger days, and I felt like, you know, there has been a series of things that happened that let me know that now was the right time. And I'm confident that that was the right decision, but that doesn't mean it was an easy one.
No, I know. Yeah. Well, let's begin with some definitions first and foremost. So what constitutes sexual harassment or sexualized violence, and how different are they?
You know, I think it would depend on the context in which we're asking the question, because those things have legal definitions that vary by jurisdiction. And there are federal statutes and state statutes, and probably places where there are local ones. I think that what might be helpful is that if we agree that we're talking about this largest umbrella of sexualized violence, and it includes sexual harassment, and includes a lot of other things as well. Sexual harassment takes a lot of different forms, including some that are indirect. So the most common kind, and the kinds that we're seeing in the news, are quid pro quo harassment, where someone in power over another person withholds or offers promotion benefit of some kind in exchange for sexual favors of some kind, and that comes with a lot of coercion and pressure. And that's the most common kind, but it's not the only kind.
That's common.
Yes, it's very common.
More common than inappropriate touch.
That's a good question. So many times the inappropriate touch isn't reported. So we have no idea. You know, I think that what we're seeing now with Me Too and the women and men and who are speaking up about the violence that they've experienced is that, you know, I'm sure, like me, you probably don't have many friends that haven't been inappropriately touched.
Right.
I don't have any women friends. I have a number of male friends who've also been harassed in that way. So I don't know that and once you start, I think, to say, well, what's more common, what's less common, then we run the risk of, like, ranking it in terms of worse. It's all awful, and it needs to stop.
Right.
You know, the use of power in sex without consent is not okay. The use of sex as a tool, the things that women have had to navigate, and it's not exclusive to women, but in the workplace, in professional realms, in academic realms, in family realms, that power dynamic where women have been have engaged in sex that they didn't want or had different kinds of sexual contacts or conversations that they didn't want and that they had no power to get out of, that's what I think is up for us as a culture, and that's what is being looked at, and I hope it changes.
So here's something that's been on my mind for a very, very, very long time, and it touches on the power dynamic, because I'm wondering if there really always has to be such. When I was a young working woman in the Bronx, and I worked in Manhattan and on Wall Street, and I had to take the subway every day. And anybody who knows the New York City subways knows that you get packed in like sardines. And if you didn't get a seat, you had to stand. And so one evening coming home from work, a packed subway car, and I was wearing, I don't know if you remember these things called ponchos, these little things you slip over your head.
Yes, ma'am, I am that old.
Okay. So I had a poncho on, and it's crowded, and I'm being pushed against, and some man from behind put his hand under and grab my privates. And although I had had many things like that happen to me, and I always froze, on this occasion, I yelled out some words that I can't say on the radio. But trust me, I call him every mother in the book as loud as I could. And he started to push his way out to get away from me because I was going after him. And train stop, he got out. End of that story. And I was shook up, just shook up for quite some time after. What's the power dynamic there, except that he had me in a place that I couldn't escape?
Mm-hmm. Right. And he felt like he had a right to do that to you. So the cultural scripting about gender, especially then, back in our poncho wearing days, the cultural scripting was even stronger than it is now about men's entitlement to the bodies of women. And that there are movements of men who insist that that's still the case, but they're wrong. And I think that when you change the script like that, you know, he ran away like the scared dog he was.
Yeah. So in trying to understand the psychology of this, because, you know, I'm always one like, why do people do this or that? Where does it come from? And you and I both know, and I think most people listening know, most men do not behave in this way, but an awful lot do, to the varying degrees, from inappropriate touch to saying stupid things, saying sexualized, inappropriate things. You know, this is true.
What I would say is that most of the people who do that are male. Yes.
Yes.
But that's not the same thing as saying most men do that.
No. I'm saying most men don't do that.
But most of the people who do that
are men.
Yeah.
So,
well over 90%.
So, is this behavior learned? Like, if you were sexually violated as a child, a male, Did that set the stage for this man to become an offender? Where does it all begin?
Well, I think that it's ubiquitous enough that there have to be multiple pathways. It couldn't just be one thing, although certainly someone being abused as a child or witnessing the abuse and harassment of women as a child could predispose that person to behave in that way. But there are many factors that do that. And some of them are just because of the messages that young men, when they're taught how to be men, are given. And the language that gets conveyed in male private spaces about what's okay behavior, men demonstrating masculinity via the demonstration of power over women. So it can come from many directions, and here I go already. My favorite answer to every question in psychology is it depends.
Yeah.
There are many things that could lead that individual to do that, and there are lots of preventions that we should be taking as we give people more flexibility about gender, help people understand the power there is in tenderness, help people remove the violence from the masculinization of boys. And all of those things, I think, will go a long way toward changing this culture. But the biggest factor is women right now saying, you know what? Enough. Mm-hmm. This is stopping now.
Yeah. And it's amazing to me that was it really Harvey Weinstein that opened the floodgates here, or has this been brewing and festering, and it was just sort of the right moment, and he was so disgusting in all of his manifestations. That seemingly opened the floodgates to where we are today. And every day, you know, I was telling friends as I was preparing for this, I can't be finished with preparation until just before we go on air, because every day is another thing, another thing. And it's like, well, good. Let's see what happens, how we change this. And maybe we'll get to some strategies and things like that. Let me reintroduce you, please. Dr. Melinda Myers is my guest, and we're talking about sexualized violence and sexual harassment. And my goal for this evening is to try and understand the dynamics in play and what we can do together to change the paradigm. And I'm how much of the fix is on? See, I kind of feel it's like on all of us, not just the men. But I don't know. I'm not so sure.
Well, men holding other men accountable, and I'm using that phrase, I'm meaning gendered, not sexed, which is a whole nother conversation. But men talking to men in the spaces in which that's all who are there is men. And calling each other out, not encouraging the behavior. So when men begin to brag about sexual exploits, for example, which is something that has been part of the expression of the masculine gender for far longer than you and I have been around. When other men stop rewarding that behavior, they say an alternative narrative like, hey, you know, if we were talking about your sister
or your mother,
would you use this language? And that's not, you know, women shouldn't be respected because of their relationships to men. And I don't mean to sound it that way, but sometimes because I think empathy and realness kind of are at the root of what we need to do to fix everything.
Yes.
I think helping men experience empathy for the women that they're talking about, and men are in a unique position, I think, to call other men out on that in private. You know, have you ever noticed that it's really hard to teach people when they're afraid? It's really hard to teach people if they're overwhelmed by shame.
Yes.
But right? But in that private space, like when your kid is doing something and you need him to do something different, you and I know that the more effective way to do that is to be empathetic and firm and clear, but that once you activate fear or shame, your kids can't hear you anymore because they're too busy defending themselves.
Exactly.
And that's true with this as well. You know, we can't rehabilitate this entire cultural gender role through these huge and public shamings. Not that they aren't deserved. Yeah. But we're not going to change Harvey Weinstein.
No.
You know, we need to protect women from him because his pattern of behavior is set. But it's other men who are around him, young men, you know, the men who I teach, you know, the men who are around on our campus. My four sons. Good Lord. I have done a whole lot of discussion about this in private. And when it's just me and my kid, you know, being like, huh. So let me say back to you what I just heard. But, you know, I'm a psychologist.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, you have lucky sons to have you to do that. I imagine that's a very difficult thing to do, even in my own personal family dynamic mm-hmm. of, you know, being violated when I was somewhere between 10 and 11 years old. And I wanted to talk about it, and I did. And somewhere along the line, I got shut down. Mm-hmm. And do you think, since we're on this train of thought, that women and or men who are sexually, can I just use the term sexually violated?
Yeah.
That messes with us, especially if we're young, as we're trying to mature and grow? Because I would have to say it did for me. I did some horrific, stupid things to myself as a younger woman because I couldn't figure out why all these things were happening to me, not knowing then that it was probably happening to
right.
so many others around me. And I'm old now, so, you know, I'm talking mm-hmm. way, way back.
So you're saying that the story you told yourself was that this was your fault in some way?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's another narrative. Like, and you can see it when a young girl is doing that. And then you can say, are you making up a story that goes like this? It's easier, I think, than using accusatory language when you say, like, you are, when you invite people to examine their own process, like a story, you can help them write a different one. The idea that somehow there's some behavior we can engage in and that the natural consequence of that is that we get mistreated is a false one. And it's important that we continue to say that. No, that doesn't make sense. It's actually the problem there. The reason this happened to you is not because you were drinking, walking there, wearing that. The problem is you ran into a rapist. And if you hadn't run into a rapist, you would have been fine. You know, so one of the things, I noticed this, there's a woman, and to me this story is interesting because this is a woman of color who said this, and she lost her job for saying something that I've actually said for a really long time. So I'm going to say it. And what she said is she was being outraged and facetious, but she said what we should do is take these privileged white boys and keep them away from everybody else because they're dangerous. Now, I get what she's saying, because what I have said for years when I'm talking to my students about preventing sexualized violence is I say, well, Sarah, here's what we'll do. Enough of this, like, buddy system with women. What we need to do is make sure that no men are allowed out after dark and that they're not allowed to drink. And if we take care of those two things, then we're going to eliminate most of the problem, right? Now, you laugh and I laugh and my students all laugh because obviously we can't do that. And what I just said is sexist, but it's also, it also flips the script about who we blame for this stuff, because it's part of that message. You know, if you can't control your own behavior when you drink, and part of your behavior is to sexually violate other people, then you shouldn't drink. So that's, you know, I'm keeping in mind that I've been talking to other people, 17 and 18 year olds, for a really long time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it takes that sort of language to get people to think about it in a new way.
Yeah.
Because they invariably say, well, no, we can't make men not go out at night. I go, well, why? You're telling women not to.
Right. See, and I've struggled with that in my own head too, because sometimes I'll tell young women, you know, well, this is just me. I don't drink. I never did drink. And part of the reason why is because I never wanted to feel that much out of control. You know, I had enough of that. So if I don't drink, I'm kind of like I could fight you back if I had to, you know. But that's not fair either, because why shouldn't women, us, be allowed to go drink and have fun without the fear of the guy who's drinking? And but I don't understand that either. Why are we talking about sociopaths? Are we talking about people, men who commit rape? That's a horrific crime. Mm-hmm. There's got to be more to it than just that he was drinking. And
You're right. It also has to do with his ideas about what sex means and what consent means. And, you know, I think it bears reiterating that while almost all perpetrators of sexualized violence are men, not all, there are many men who are victims of sexualized violence, right, and they are victims at the hand of other men.
Yeah.
Very few women commit sexualized violence. When they do, they're often the accomplices of men. But it doesn't really matter.
Right.
You know, what we're talking about is the importance of respecting people's consent, seeking it, and clarifying it. And that the nature of how that, and how healing from that occurs. And I said this to you in our exchanges before we decided to do this show, and that is that it's important also to keep in mind that most of us have experienced this, as we've made clear. And almost all of us turn out okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have lovely lives. We have satisfying relationships as adults. It doesn't doom us. And it doesn't doom victims who are not women either. But it's this thing that gets part of our story and part of the way we understand the world. And sometimes I think people cordon it off and not think about it. And sometimes that can come out later in ways that aren't predictable.
So why are women less inclined to be perpetrators of sexualized violence?
Boy, that's a good question, Sharon. Without looking at doing a literature search and figuring it out, we don't gender women in the same way to believe that they have power over other people.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to NPR today, which I do a lot, and I heard a woman in power of in business say that the solution to this is more women in power.
Mm-hmm.
And she's probably right.
Mm-hmm.
But women haven't been raised to think that they can do this to other people. Most bullies are also male. Most bullies of every kind, including the sexual kind, are male. Not all of them, but most of them.
Is that cross-cultural? I mean, all over the world?
Mm-hmm. That's what the data suggests, yes.
So, I was talking to some men, I won't mention their names, it doesn't matter, who think that that it's I don't want to say genetic, but it's ingrained, or it's somewhere in the male psyche, you know, because a man, when he looks at a beautiful woman, he gets all these thoughts and yada yada, and it's just the way it is.
It's called a natural fallacy.
Explain that.
It's the idea that somehow there's something in the DNA of the male sex that makes this happen, and there's zero evidence for this.
Oh.
And there have been a lot of people who've looked at it. It's one thing. It's like the difference. You know, Sharon, have you ever been really mad? Like really, really mad?
I'd have to say yes. A couple times,
okay,
to be
couple
sure.
Times. Me too.
Yeah.
Now, most of the time when I'm really, really mad, that doesn't mean that I'm going to throw a chair across the room.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Because there's a difference between the feeling of anger and the behavior of throwing a chair across the room. There's a difference of the feeling of attraction. And I would argue that humans feel attraction a lot of the times when their consciences, society, agreements with other people prevent them from acting on it. Right? Like, we all feel attraction. You know, I hope that you still walk through the produce aisle at the co-op and see a handsome person sometimes and go, damn.
Of course.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Right. But that doesn't mean that you go over there and squeeze the cantaloupe.
Exactly.
You know?
That's
just
that's
doesn't.
Well said, Melinda.
Right? Yeah. And that's, I think, that's what I mean, is that, yes, I absolutely agree that people do experience attraction. But there's a big difference between whatever private thing you're experiencing and you're feeling that you have the right to share it with someone else. That requires consent.
So are we talking about impulse control as well? I mean, on the part of, well, men?
I think we're talking about manners.
Manners.
Right? Like, we got to teach people that this isn't appropriate. The same way you teach people about the kind of language they use when there's a grandma around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, just like, this is like, we don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
You help people learn to behave in socially appropriate ways. And I think what's happened is that until now, it has been considered socially appropriate to behave in these really abominable ways. Expected, even, that if you were a woman and you wanted to move up in Hollywood, or you wanted to move up in your corporation, or in some cases you wanted to move up in your university, that this was part of the game that you had to play.
Oh, yeah. What did they call that in Hollywood? The couch? The
casting couch.
Casting couch. Boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Is it okay for a man to say to a woman on a casual basis, oh, you look lovely today?
Somebody he knows or somebody he doesn't know?
Ah, see, it depends. Let's start with someone you don't know.
I would say no.
Mm-hmm. And say why.
Well, it's this, you know, there's a lot of stuff been going on the internet and in the culture about stop telling women that you don't know that they should smile. And that has that happened to you? It's happened to me a lot of times. Oh, you'd be so pretty if you'd just smile.
Oh.
A man I don't know walking by me on the street, smile, you're beautiful.
Oh.
Like somehow magically, this is his right to say this to me.
Gotcha.
And that I should care what he thinks and that I should smile. Mm-hmm. It's like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You may be from the Bronx, but yeah, I'm from Arcata, and I wouldn't mess with me if I were you.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that, that part of it is that. No, you don't have the right to invade someone else's space, even to pay them a compliment.
Right.
And you could ask, is it all right if I pay you a compliment? The person says, no, you don't. You don't argue. You don't ask again. You don't try another way. You walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Someone that you do know, like in the context of a relationship, I'm pretty sure that your handsome husband who adores you for 42 years pays you a compliment now and again, and it's a nice
now
thing.
Now and again.
Line two, it's a nice thing.
Yeah, it is.
Right? And so that's, I think, the difference. It has to do with the context of the relationship and whether or not there's consent. But if someone in power over me pays me a compliment, my response to that compliment determines part of whether or not I get a promotion, I get to keep my job, right? And so women are in this really awkward position because we don't like compliments from strangers for the most part. You know, the research about that is pretty clear. Ask women who don't know, when you say something to them, they don't know whether you are dangerous or not. And we have to make that call all the time, every day, multiple times a day.
Right.
And so you're putting that person you don't know in the position of having to address that thing. And she could be, like, you know, doing fractals in her head. She could be, you know,
anything. She
anything.
Could have just lost her job, or
it's
someone that she loves
your
died, and
right.
you're approaching her uninvited with your opinion about how she looks.
Right.
So around my dining room table, you know, talking and talking all week about this, and so can I put my hand on someone's back? And of course, I'm learning from you. It's in context, you know. Do you know me? And know, are we familiar enough that that would be okay or not?
Mm-hmm.
There was something on TV today. I don't remember what I was watching. But a group of men, I don't know if they were like a city council or something, and I don't even remember where it was. A man sitting next to another man for a split second puts his hand, you saw it, and I'm here, and the other guy had a cow.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at that, and I thought, well, that, where,
He had a reaction coming from a place of homophobia.
Yes, he did.
And... you know, I think it all is about the context. And I think consent is, you got to have consent before you touch somebody.
So even in that thing where the guy just sort of went like that for a split
second? It would depend
on
the nature of their relationship, how well they knew each other. But usually if somebody reaches over and does that to someone else, they're behaving in a dominant way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you can't do that to someone else.
Yeah.
And to be aware that that's what that means and that's what that signals and be more conscious about it would be helpful.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about hugging. I'm a hugger.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah. And, of course, with people I know I can get a hug. Mm-hmm. If it's someone I don't know and I'm feeling like, let's say somebody has come with something sad or whatever and I don't know them, I'll say, can I give you a hug?
Yeah. Yes.
And that's just sort of intuitive. You know, why would you hug somebody you don't know? That doesn't make sense either to me.
But if you see somebody in pain, it can be a natural reaction that you want to, like, offer comfort.
Yeah.
But it only takes a split second to say, may I give you a hug?
Right.
And the other person, almost all the time when that happens to me, they're like, yes, please.
Yeah.
And they melt into my arms. But, you know, a lot of times it's a student in a great deal of distress, too.
Right. And you
where
don't
it's just
know.
The right thing to do. But I ask.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be asked before someone does that to me.
Yeah. So I'd been thinking, you know, we're hearing about all the famous people that have done these things and what's happened to some of them and not to others of them. But I think about just regular people, you know, restaurant workers, people who work in the field, women of color, LGBT, school teachers, janitors, you know, those of us with little or no power, but we're like the breath of the universe. And we're beginning to come out, you know, day by day. But how sad is it as a society that us have so little venue to tell our stories, to tell our truths in order, I think, to change it. 'Cause if we don't talk about it, it will never change. And if we all come out, wow.
Which is what I think you're seeing.
Yeah, and that's why I'm talking to people, you know, at my table, you know. Well, people obviously that I know, but not well enough to, you know, have asked that question before, but I'm asking it now. I have a safe house, you know, I'm in a safe home. And some people know, you know, my own experience, so they're not afraid to share, but I'm blown away by the answers now that I'm getting. 'Cause like, oh my God. Me too. You too. You know, men in prison that are fortunate enough to be in support groups, when they sit around and talk about childhood, and one guy says, yeah, you know, my mother hit me with a belt and yada, yada, blah, whatever. And the next guy's turn and he goes, you too? And next one, you too, me too, me too, me too. And you come to find out that you're not alone.
Right.
That these things happen. And fortunately, in some of these programs, I don't mean to digress about people being in prison, but they're getting the tools. They're learning how to process what has happened to them and then how to move forward so that they don't do that to their loved ones, to their children. So what about those of us with little power? What do you think we ought to be doing to get our stories out there to where we can affect change? How do we talk about them?
Yeah. Well, I think we have to learn to talk and we have to learn to listen about it. So we have to understand when someone shares that. We have to really think about everything that went into that person's decision to tell us right now. And listen. And the power of speaking truth is healing in and of itself. Like you let it out, and then when you realize you're not alone, this is true about anything. You know, my students who have test anxiety, they think they're the only kid in the room that's afraid to take a test.
Yeah.
And I know my tests have been really hard, but they're afraid of every test.
Yeah.
And they find out they're not the only one, and they're like, oh, okay, so now we can talk about it. And I think this is similar, that there is this strength that comes from, okay, we have all experienced this, we're going to talk about it, and when we hear other people using those kinds of words to others, or we see something that doesn't look right, I think we're going to be more likely to intervene, and that's going to stop it too.
I also think that there is some cultural aspect to this, and here's why I say that. I was thinking, looking back, when I was young, when I was a kid, it was cute. It was thought of as cute to pinch a woman's backside. Mm-hmm. We used to say, we used to call it copping a feel, goosing. You goose a girl. Boys did that, and it was funny. Mm-hmm. The guy would, you know, two guys would be together, go goose her, and you'd go and pinch mm-hmm. a butt or something.
Yeah. Snap a bra strap or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Crack up, you know. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't remember thinking of it as terrible, but I know I didn't like it.
Right.
You know?
I remember being really embarrassed by it, really uncomfortable by it. And I also remember that there was no consequence at all.
None.
To the boys.
Right.
In this case, it was all boys who did it. There was never a consequence. And I remember, you know, it's happened to me in the fifth grade. And
me too in
you know,
the fifth grade.
A lot. And I think, you know, in that age, the girls are bigger than the boys because we get puberty earlier. I remember my teacher inferring that it was my fault because I, after all, was the one who brought the breasts to school.
Oh.
And that if I just didn't have those, then, you know, and that they were, that, but, you know, we wore those peasant dresses, right?
Oh, yes.
You probably had them to the elastic everywhere. So they would grab the front of my dress and pull it down. And that was considered to be... my feelings about it were definitely not ever considered.
Right.
You know, it was just, well, duh.
Yeah.
Of course that happened.
Yeah.
Like, well, no, not. And now schools intervene. That kind of thing gets kids sent home now.
Is it being taught? I mean, don't just send the kid home, but are we having in kindergarten and preschool and things about inappropriate touch?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes. Depending on the school district, yes.
Boy. Yeah. Seems to me like it needs to start at home, but if it can't start at home, empower our children very early. That's the only way, mm-hmm. you know, I think, among other solutions that we'll get to. So I'm here with Dr. Melinda Myers. She just retired from teaching at Humboldt State after a very long time.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going anywhere, though, you know, like. I went to I was born in the annex. I went to elementary school in Guest Hall.
Yeah, you've been.
I'm not going anywhere.
Wow. All right, and we're not engaging in on-air therapy. So, but we do both agree that getting professional help can help heal the wounds, and we encourage any of you who have been violated to do so. And I'm going to open the phones right about now, and. Michael's going to give me the text number because I don't know what it is.
That's 492-KHSU.
Oh, that's easy. 492-KHSU. You can call us at 826-4805, 1-800-640-5911 with your questions and your insights about this topic. And we'll just keep on... moving our conversation forward until you decide to call in. One in four girls experience sexual violence and one in six boys.
Mm-hmm. Before the age of 18.
Yeah. And, you know, how do we...
Wait, let me correct that. I think that's through college.
Through college?
Actually, yeah.
So that would be 18. Early 20s?
Mm-hmm.
That reflects.
So it depends on which statistic you use. That's the statistic from RAIN, usually. And in college, 25% of girls during college experience sexualized violence. One in six, one in 10 boys. But it depends on which statistic. Anyway, mm-hmm. a lot
right.
of people.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot. And, you know, I believe in due process. And, you know, some, you know, to lose your entire career and occupation without a hearing, without anything, on some level is bothersome to me. How do we respond to harm without creating more harm?
There are some, I think prevention, and here I'm hearing the voice of my colleague, Dr. Tasha Howe, who teaches global child abuse prevention strategies to all kinds of people in all kinds of places. I think we have that the first place is as much prevention as possible, teaching people what appropriate and inappropriate behavior is. And then on the other end of it is helping people recover once it's happened. And then I think due process is very important. One of the things people do in order to protect themselves psychologically is when they hear something that is so hard to tolerate, it's just so awful, that they come up with a reason why it's not so bad. So what that sounds like in the context of sexualized violence is people tell a story like this. Well, my friend got falsely accused of rape. Therefore, there must be lots of false accusations. The people who are doing it because it's so hard to tolerate the idea that there actually is a whole lot of sexualized violence out there, which is true. So when you understand the kinds of mechanisms that people do in order to be able to tolerate, you know, how do you just go about your daily life? How do you continue to live in this society? How do you, you know, feel okay about just doing what you need to do in a day if this is the case? So people come up with psychological strategies to discount it to themselves. And what the Me Too campaign is doing is it's making it a lot harder to pretend that. Now, I'm with you. I think due process is very important. So take somebody like Harvey Weinstein, right? How many, or Bill Cosby?
Yes.
How many of exactly the same story told by many dozens of women
right.
over many years does it take before we believe them?
Right.
And I feel like, you know, I believed Anita Hill.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
Right? But I'm thinking about how different that would have played now.
Yeah.
Although there are many other factors at play there. The fact that she's a woman of color affects the way her story's heard. And I think we have to pay attention to the things that we're doing.
All right. We have a caller, and it is Susan from Crescent City. Go ahead,
yep.
Susan.
So I was just going to share that I had an experience once with a professor at Humboldt State. And what happened, the professor wrote me a letter, and it was about 8 pages long. I actually thought it was a lab assignment that I got back. It was when I was a graduate student. And I took it home and read it, and it was this 8-page letter suggesting that every time I asked questions in class, I was just trying to lure him in, and that, you know, it went on and on like that for 8 pages. And it basically ended by saying that I either had to decide that I wanted a relationship with him or that I wouldn't see him anymore, which, of course, I was in a class that was required. So I managed to talk to another professor who kind of guided me through it, and they hired a counselor from off campus to talk to me. And I was also advised that I could not tell anyone or I would face a libel suit.
Even though you had an 8-page letter in your hand.
Yes.
That's awful. I'm so sorry.
It was awful. And then I was told that I could file a lawsuit, but it would require all kinds of court time. And at the time, I just was going through a very lengthy divorce, and I was also in graduate school, and I really didn't have the time to do this court thing, right? So then I got offered the option to switch out of his class, and I did. But when I did, I wanted my statement to read that he had written a letter that was harassing, and they told me that he refused. And so I said, well, then how about if a copy of the letter is attached to my request to change out of the class. And he actually agreed to that, which I thought I found shocking because the letter itself was so clear. And so I ended up in another class, but I was told I couldn't tell anybody. So I had to tell all my colleagues, all my cohorts, that, oh gosh, it was just inconvenient with my schedule to stay in this class, which nobody else had the luxury of doing.
Mm-hmm. How long? Can I ask you how long ago that this was?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been about 20 years now.
Yeah, so it's before Title IX was implemented on our campus. But I know other stories like this. That
right.
is just, were you able to finish your graduate degree, Susan?
Yes.
Good.
Yes. But the other interesting thing is that several years later, a couple years later, something else happened where that particular professor was jailed for a short period of time because of making threats to his wife, and he had once told me that I reminded him of his wife in an angry way, which freaked me out. Then I went to one of my professors who was a counselor, told her about it, and she just goes, oh, that's nothing like what he did. You know, you shouldn't be experiencing any of this and any of this fear or PTSD or whatever, you know. I mean, I was just blown off, basically, by the department, by
and
the
there's
school.
No consequences that befell that.
Other than my getting removed from the class and taking a much harder independent study, no.
Wow.
Because I think that the professor who got me, who was in the same department, was kind of PO'd, you know? And so he just slammed me with this assignment. But I do have to say that by the end, I think he liked me. And it was okay.
Way to survive.
3 years later, I was called by the university, and there was another letter, very much like this. And I learned there had been one almost identical to mine prior. So this was the third time with this professor. And I don't know what the consequences were, because they were asking me if I would testify, and I would have, but I was never called again. So
you don't know whatever happened to
him? I do not know what ever happened to that person.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
But I do know what, you know, for me, I mean, it's yes, like you were saying before, you go on with your life. Your life is good.
Yeah.
And it's just a piece of your history. Yeah. But boy, during the moment, it was an awful piece of my history. And it was not. And I did not feel supported by anyone but one professor from another department.
Male or female?
Female.
Mm-hmm. Susan, what are you thinking about, you know, like what's happening on a daily basis since the Harvey Weinstein story came out?
Well, it's like, it's not flooring to me. It's kind of, it's not surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know it happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice that it's being talked about, that in the ideal world, things will change. It is amazing, of course, that our leader of our country is also sitting on charges like that, and it's not touching him.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure he had the money to buy off all complaints, and so nobody can come back. But yeah, that's how I feel. I mean, it's horrible that it happens. I hope it changes. And like you also, somebody, Sharon, suggested that it's like we need to teach our boys how to treat women, how to treat girls.
Yes, we do. But in your case, you weren't talking about a boy.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a professor who had power over you in a program where there was no other course you could take. And unfortunately, I've heard other stories like that. In my tenure year here, I had a student who was sexually assaulted by a professor in another department.
Ooh.
And she, the situation was just so difficult. You know, he so clearly should have been fired.
Mm-hmm.
The assault happened on campus in that person's office. There was just no excuse for it.
Right.
And what that young person went through was really difficult.
Right.
And I've heard other stories like that. And I think that You know, I'm thinking about my colleagues in the Dean of Students' office here now. I know how seriously those charges are handled now. Although, boy, we have far from a perfect track record. And I'm just so sorry, Susan. I wish that had never happened, and I wish it weren't such a common occurrence. Thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you guys for doing this.
You're welcome. We have another caller on the line. It's bye-bye, Susan, and it's anonymous. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm guessing that's me.
That's you.
So, first of all, I really appreciate that you have this this show and this discussion. I had my the button that pushed me to call was a little concern about one thing you said, and I also want to respond to one thing that the previous caller said. But one, I totally support. I'm very happy that these things are bubbling up in society. Sadly, that they're there, but I'm glad that these things are coming to the fore because, my gosh, they're there. I hope I didn't break the rule of cussing there just now by saying, my gosh. But you said a couple things that I felt was a contradiction, and I have a little problem with, especially in the PC, be careful about what you say world that we're in right now. On the one hand, you said, don't, something to the effect, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, I basically don't compliment a woman that you don't know. And on the other hand, it said, you said, well, it depends on the context. And I make it a point, in fact, I'm in education. I make it a point, one, never to compliment people at work. Unless like, oh, that's a nice sweater or something like that. I just don't make compliments about personal things. I just deal professionally. But if I see somebody out in the public, at the store, the grocery store, or whatever, I'll say something. I try to make a point of saying something, and my first phrase was, if I see somebody, and that is male or female, I look for something to compliment on, and I oftentimes do it for women, typically women who are 10 to 20 to 30 years older than me. But I do it, and I make a point of doing it and moving on immediately, so I'm not looking to get like, oh, well, that was very nice. I just want to say something nice about that person without reaping any, you know, oh, you're such a nice young man or whatever.
I'll just tell you that what the data say is 85% of women want you to not do that. And without data, you're just another person with an opinion. And I can appreciate that the spirit is one of kindness and that you know what your intention is. But what I'm trying to convey to you is that the person you're saying it to does not know your intention. And that is a very important part of the equation.
I hear that. And so my small point, and I'll leave it at this, is that I try to make my intention clear by saying it in the manner that I say it, and moving right past so that they're left with a compliment and I'm out of the picture. So I know what your data says, and that's mostly because of the way the whole situation we have with men and women. And so one of the things that the caller said about, you know, the way you should treat women and girls, and the thing that stuck in my craw a little bit there is like, no, the way we need to treat human beings with full respect as if we are all just human beings. And that's sort of simplistic and silly coming out at this moment, probably to some people. But it's not like you're a girl and you're a boy and, oh, you're a girl, so I need to treat you this way, oh, with respect. Mm-hmm. No, you're a human being and I will treat you equally as I would any other human being.
I think that it's good if we decide that we'll agree that everyone deserves to be treated with respect. However, not everyone experiences the world in the same way. So that to deny the power of gender in the social exchanges you're talking about would be analogous to pretending that one could be colorblind in terms of race. And that's not true either, because the world is not experienced the same way by people of color compared to those of us with the privilege of walking around in white bodies. But I think that your point is taken. We appreciate your call. And I will leave it with the agreement
that always deserve respect. And I agree with what you just said. I totally understand that. It's simply a matter of we start looking at people first as the individual, John or Jane, and not their other factors that we that are part of what the differences of humans. Just like there's an individual person that we need to treat with respect.
We hear you.
But thank you so much.
And we thank you for the call. That was right on. All right. It's a couple of minutes early, but I know I'm within the window to tell you that you're listening to KHSU and KHSU HD 90.5 Arcata, KHSR 91.9 Crescent City, and KHSG 89.9 Garberville. And I'm Sharon, and I'm here with my guest, Melinda Myers, Dr. Myers, and we're talking about all this stuff. Sexual violence, sexual harassment, how we treat each other, trying to figure out where we're going to go from here. And I believe we have another caller on the line, and it is Jane from Arcata. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Firstly, I just want to say thank you so much for having this program. You're just really hitting the nail on the head, and I'm super grateful for you covering this. So I'm calling because when I owned a store in downtown Arcata, I once did a window display. And the window display that I did was on sexual harassment. More or less, you know, addressing street harassment. Mm. Because as a female business owner who had mostly female employees, we on a daily basis had to deal with street harassment. And when I did this window display, now this window display had a male mannequin wearing a t-shirt that said, this is what a feminist looks like. And it had a female mannequin, and then it had lots of statistics on pieces of paper glued to the front of the window. And then I started employing women to, if they felt comfortable, post their experiences on 3x5 cards and put them on my window. So that's what I did. And I will tell you that although I got probably hundreds of people coming in thanking me for this window, I also received a tremendous amount of backlash. And it was really difficult. Everything from threatening notes wrapped in toilet paper with human feces through my mail slot. Things written on the window that were threatening towards us. And it was just, I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe this was the backlash I was getting. Then, you know, of the what I would call regular perpetrators that I was familiar with around my area started coming into the store and saying things to us and threatening. And there was one man who tried to come in and say, I just don't understand what is wrong with me complimenting a woman on what she looks like or her outfit. Mm. And I did everything in my power to say, you know, well, why is it that you feel the need to tell her that?
Yeah, exactly.
Why do you need to tell her that? Like, why can't you just appreciate her from afar and let her have her power and her independence and her space on the street to walk down a public sidewalk? You know? And they just couldn't seem to understand it. And I found myself trying to kind of back down and, like, understand where they were coming from just to try and get them to then maybe hear my perspective. But I never felt like I got anywhere. And ultimately, the bottom line is I finally, I think the window was up for, I don't know, maybe a month. And then I finally took it down because, you know, then people were literally carving things into the glass of my window.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, you know, in this space, I had also, I mean, my female employees and myself, you know, we couldn't really go get lunch without being commented on or harassed every single time we went to get lunch. So we brought our own lunches to work so that we didn't have to leave. You know, and it just, it became such a problem that, well, I moved my store. And I'm in a better place now, and that's great. But
can I just say me too?
Yeah, me too, you know? And, you know, and the problem still exists, and I still care about it. I mean, I'm in a better place, but the rest of the world isn't. So I'm just, like, I wish I had more tools. I wish I had more ways of trying to communicate to these men and get them to understand. But I just feel so frustrated not being able to get them to understand, you know? And so, anyway.
So
there's my piece.
Hang on one second.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Hang on. I want to ask, stay on the line. I want to ask Melinda.
Sure.
So, Melinda, if you were in her store and some one of these people came in that's been harassing her and giving her a hard time, and you're there, knowing all that you know, what would you do?
Oh, I would have tried to do exactly what she did. Okay. She approached that person compassionately and assuming that they would want to know. And, you know, the person is thinking to themselves, well, I'm a well-meaning person. I know I'm not dangerous, so I should be allowed to have this exchange. There, it's so hard to help people see that it isn't about what you think or what you intend. It's about the message that gets received.
Yeah.
And that the interpretive filter in between there is culture and society and thousands of years of men using power inappropriately over women. So I applaud you. I totally get it. When my store was on the plaza in Arcata, we experienced that. I used to dread walking to the bank because of what I got. And, you know, I totally understand that experience. There's a great, I think it's Radiolab, I don't think it's This American Life, recently, where a young reporter in Australia.
Actually,
did you hear that?
I know.
That was the greatest piece.
I've heard it twice, and it's really great.
It took her months to convince this person that his, and he was doing more catcalling than just complimenting, but it took her months. She took it as a mission and then recorded it, what it took to convince this guy. And I don't know that she ever got through. But I think
in the end she kind of got through. He agreed that he would at least not go up and grab a woman's
He agreed not to grope women he didn't know in the dance club.
Yeah, but that was as far as it went.
All right. Well, we thank you for your call.
Thank you so much again for doing this. You're doing a great job.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You know, that reminds me. We have another caller on the line. We'll get to you in 1 second, caller. But growing up in New York City and in the Bronx and Manhattan, catcalls were a daily occurrence multiple times a day. And, again, I can't use the language on the radio, but trust me, when a man would or a guy would give me some unwanted attention of a sexual nature, especially, the words that came out of my mouth were fighting words. And I did. It was like, no, you know, and guys did really some disgusting things as you would walk by. Why do we have to live like that? That's just wrong. But, you know, we're turning the page, I do believe. Do we still have a caller on the line? We've got Lorna. Lorna, thank you for your patience.
Well, thank you for having me. And I must first preface by saying it's irrational that I have this feeling of nervousness calling right now because I'm never on this side of the conversation. But thank you for taking my call and thank you for doing this show. I want to address the comment of the gentleman who called two calls before. And I would like for him to consider two words. And those two words are intention and impact. Now, this gentleman mentioned that his intentions were purely innocent, and it was for the purpose of complimenting and then walking away. And he mentioned that he was obvious in his behavior to alert the person who he was complimenting that it was innocent and it meant nothing more than just giving some person a good word for the day. His intention is totally innocent and it comes from a good place. But he has no idea how his intention will impact the receiver.
Right. He has none. And he had no empathy for that. It was his assumption was that his intention was what would be conveyed. It's such a common thing, right, Lorna? Like, people do that all the time.
Absolutely. And the person who is impacted in a negative way, even though that's not his intention, has absolutely no right to feel that way because his intentions were good. He needs to consider that.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I see your point. Right. Right, right, right.
Exactly.
And the reason for his reaction was that person had absolutely no right to misconstrue his intention for something other than an innocent thing.
And if she did, it was her fault.
Yeah, and he has no right to assume that his intention will impact the woman in an innocent way.
Right. And I think that's the point, is that we really, you know, I understand a little bit where he might be coming from. You know, you're in the, I do this. I'm telling you, if I see a woman or a guy and they're wearing something awesome, I'm going to say that is a gorgeous hat. That's my personality, you know.
That Wu-Tang Clan Christmas sweater I saw the other day was epic.
So, and maybe I'm wrong to do that, you know, to just offer a compliment about somebody's hat. But maybe because I'm a woman, it's not perceived in a negative way as it would be from a man, because it gets kind of creepy if you don't know the guy and he's suddenly telling you how beautiful you look. It's like unwanted. Do we have another call?
Well, can I just say this, Sharon, to what you just said?
Yes. No.
It goes the same thing. You have no idea how your compliment will impact that man.
Right. You don't.
Because that whatever item you're complimenting, it could have been given to him by his grandmother that passed away that day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good point.
You have great intention, but you don't know how it will impact him.
Right. Right.
So
I hate to think of going through life without giving compliments to people, but to strange people, maybe. Maybe I won't do that anymore. All right, Lorna, we got calls backed up.
All right, thank you.
All right, El Boogie, thanks for the call. Okay, we have Anonymous on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, is that me?
If you're Anonymous, it's you.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not on the radio anymore, but I had called in.
You are on the radio. You are on the radio. Did you hear me?
Yes, but I'm not listening.
Oh, okay.
I'm not listening, so I wasn't able to know that. But thank you very much. Great show. And I wanted to address the issue around the compliments, listening to the gentleman who called in several minutes ago. And I thought I'd offer this as a little bit of a frame or explanation for people who might not understand this. But such compliments, as well-intentioned as they may be from the person giving that compliment, and I think Dr. Myers addressed this, they can trigger. So when, even though I'm a nice older lady and some young man might say something kind to me about how nice I look today, that can trigger for me instantly. What does that person want? What are his, why is he targeting me? What, you know, so there's all these things that can go through my mind, even though I may just want to accept the compliment, like, oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the reaction that is somewhat biological, I think, for a lot of women, because we have been so primed to be wary when a person we do not know, usually male, but I guess it could be female, approaches us and offers a comment on our person. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to offer that.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. That's very valid. I don't get those kind of compliments anymore. So I haven't considered that in a while. Okay, thank you. Do we have another?
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Okay, all right. 826-4805 is the number to call. And we have another 20 minutes or so. And boy, the time has flown. I'm going to get into this a little bit while Michael takes the next call coming in. This is an area we haven't discussed yet, but it's important to me. And probably a lot of other people too. It's an opinion from the New York Times And it goes like this. I'm going to read quickly as best I can. This week, Time Magazine announced its Person of the Year is actually a group of people, the Silence Breakers, who have courageously outed the alleged sexual predation of powerful men like Weinstein, Roger Ailes. This is a sign of real progress. The hope is that this continuing national reckoning will lead to a culture in which women are able to flourish without shame or fear. But if these cases of high-profile men in politics, media, and Hollywood are the cases at which the conversation stops, we will have missed a major opportunity to examine what the very worst sexual abuse looks like and what we might do to stop it. Perhaps that's why in the weeks since the accusations of vile and criminal behavior of Harvey Weinstein altered the public consciousness, and as our understanding of sexual harassment has expanded to include all manner of merely boorish behavior, some highly influential celebrities of color, Rihanna and LeBron James among them, sought to direct our focus to the case of a 29-year-old black woman named Syntonia Brown. The facts of Ms. Brown's life are heart-rending. An elementary school dropout and runaway born with fetal alcohol syndrome at the age of 16 found herself living in a Nashville motel with an older pimp called Cutthroat, who drugged her, raped her repeatedly, and forced her into prostitution. On August 6, 2004, when she was 16, she shot and killed a 43-year-old John in his home when the man allegedly reached under his bed. She testified that she believed he was reaching for a weapon and feared for her life. She took money, she took guns, and then she fled. A jury rejected her claim of self-defense, finding her guilty of first-degree murder and aggravated robbery. She was tried as an adult and given a life sentence, which she's serving in a Tennessee prison for women. She will not be eligible for parole until 2055, when she is 67 years old. Those who follow the issue of restorative justice have known Ms. Brown's names for years. There is a 2011 documentary called Me Facing Life, dealing with her predicament, which became a factor in changing the way that Tennessee deals with child prostitution cases. But she only burst into the national consciousness last month when the Free Syntonia hashtag went viral. Fortunately, most American women cannot say Me Too about such a horrific ordeal, but the truth is that there are many more Syntonia Browns in our midst than we would like to think. Consider the case of Sarah Cruzan. And for the record, Sarah Cruzan is part of my extended family, and she's been on KHSU's airways. Her father was incarcerated, and a trafficker named George Gilbert Howard, 20 years her senior, began grooming her for sex work when she was 11 years old. And at age 17, she killed him and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Evidence of the abuse she suffered was deemed inadmissible at her trial. And though recent studies estimate that a staggering 86% of women in jail have suffered some form of sexual violence, the criminal justice system routinely fails to take this into account. 12 years into her sentence, Ms. Cruzan received a break when Human Rights Watch brought national attention to her case, prompting the governor at the time, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to commute her sentence. She was granted parole in 2013. The writer of this article says she spoke to Ms. Cruzan and Elizabeth Calvin of Human Rights Watch, who now collaborate to end the use of life sentences without parole for minors. And Sarah and Cintoya are not unique. Such abuse, Ms. Cruzan stressed, is protected by silence. It goes on from there. But this is so painful to reckon with women who have been violated in horrific ways and try to save themselves, end up being further punished. I mean, this is not an ideal life. I know Sarah Cruzan's story very, very intimately. And, you know, it makes me cry every time I think about the life she was born into. And no one could change it. No one could fix it. And then all these things happen. And then she does the unthinkable. And then they punish her more. And
it's the only way she had out of that situation.
Yep. So we have, there's a lot we have to fix in the system. What happens when a young woman accuses a man of rape and does something to defend herself? Should she be punished at all? How do we process these things that millions of women, I would guess, have suffered on top of suffering?
It's extraordinary to witness what happens to women who try to use the channels that exist, the legal channels that exist. And someone like the women that we're talking about here, they have no power. They can't like hire an attorney. They're not considered credible witnesses. There's a false belief in our culture that someone who is a sex worker can't be raped. And so there are virtually no district attorneys who will bring charges against someone in those circumstances. And it winds up with just being this morass that people can't get out of.
Yeah. We have another caller on the line, and I believe it's Sandy. Go ahead, Sandy.
Okay, thank you. You've just been talking about something that's the hard end of the spectrum. My question is not so much on this subject, but how do people or parents go about raising girls so that they can be assertive and aggressive enough and self-confident enough to speak out to someone almost immediately on these, if they're attacked verbally? Because I can remember several situations, and it just was never a problem for me, but I see the problem with others all the time. And I've heard your stories, and it wasn't a problem for you. If they came at you, your words went back.
I had plenty of those words, and it absolutely was a problem for me regardless. I think it, you know, the danger is in the belief that somehow if we just speak up, it will stop it. While I think we should be speaking up, I think it's naive to think that that will stop the violence against women.
No, I don't believe for a minute it'll stop the violence, but I think you need to assert yourself for your own dignity and to keep going.
Yes, I think there probably is a relationship there.
To be passive and accept it.
Yes.
Leaves you vulnerable not just to what they've done, but to yourself, you've done to yourself.
And to future victimization.
Yeah,
you're
and
absolutely
so as a
right.
Parent, how do you raise a child to feel that confidence that if they at least speak out, they have spoken for themselves, even if they didn't win the war?
Yeah, it starts young, you know, when you're telling your kids and believe them when they tell you things.
Yeah. Does that help?
No.
I wish it did. I wish we had an answer.
Yeah.
I wish we didn't need to do this.
No.
I didn't expect so.
No. And you know, caller, when I was a student here on campus and I'd be here at night, coming from New York City, I come with a bit of an attitude, and I would make it a point, and I still do to this day. If I'm walking on campus, it's dark, and I don't see anybody, but there's a guy, I look at that man, and I'll say, how you doing? Good evening. Make eye contact. Just to assert myself so that if he had any ill intentions, he might think twice. That's just a little strategy, you know, street smarts kind of thing, but that's
exactly.
That doesn't
work. Yeah. How do you teach that? That comes from your personality. Now, I'm too old to be a mother, but if I had a daughter, how would I? I know how my mother helped me, but it was an easier time.
Yeah.
How would I help a daughter? There's parents out there that want their daughter.
Modeling it helps. You can model it. You know, you can let your daughter see you handle it, and your sons see you handle it.
Yeah.
So that it becomes the norm. You know, I think when, depending on the generation you're in, girls were taught to be sort of quiet and meek, and fortunately that's changing.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Not that much. Listen to all these stories that we're hearing coming out of Hollywood, and I'm not. This mm-hmm. is a very different group than. A lot of other problems in the same category, but in this very specific group, nobody really would speak out. The job was more important than their own dignity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you teach a child? And this goes for men too. How do you teach dignity? There's always something somewhere else. You don't have to take it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've given us something to think about, and I want to thank you for the call. We have a short time left, and there's more to go. Thank you so much, caller. You're welcome. This must have come in via text, and I'm going to read it to the best of my ability. Rachel says, just like with racism, and the responsibility for dismantling it lies at the feet of white people, misogyny and rape culture lies at the feet of men to transform. Yet why is it the majority of the conversations and work being done around this issue is being done by women? I am saying this as a, and I'm not familiar with this term, cisgender.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It means that she performs the gender of female and was born a female.
Okay. So I'm saying this as a cisgender straight woman, by the way. When are we going to stop doing the majority of the labor-emotional and otherwise and demand that men step up and get to work educating each other and holding each other accountable? The only way we change this rape culture is for men to take responsibility for themselves. Hallelujah.
Amen, sister.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and I guess the previous caller was kind of talking around that too, how do we get the men to recognize even these little, I don't know, the term is microaggression, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I used to call them slights, you know, when somebody right. slighted you, you know.
Yeah. Shade.
And to call them out. I call them out in my own sphere, people that I live with and love and so forth, when they say stupid things. And I just say, you know, that's sexist, that's racist, that's whatever it is. And I mean it. And, you know, somebody might chuckle, you know, like, you know. But no, it's not okay. It's not okay. I think it is incumbent on males and men and boys to name it and to stop it, and when you see it, call it out. Just like racism. You know, as a white person all my life I saw it, I had to call it out. I mm-hmm. had to say, this is wrong, what you said, what you did, not okay, you know, and you know, sometimes suffer the consequences, but that's okay. And the same with this. And even I know she's saying here women do all the work. Well, duh. But women too should not stand by.
Right, and there are men doing work in this realm. Mm-hmm. Where they're yeah. not. There's a number far greater than zero of men that
yeah.
that are tackling this head on.
Yeah, and we have to believe that, and it has to be true because we can't do this by ourselves. We'll never solve this if we don't do it together. But really, I think the weight is on the male of the species to get a grip, to understand communication, to love women. You know, I always say, you know, a man who hits a woman, and that's a whole nother area of abuse that probably the floodgates would open. He, mm-hmm. this one beat me, that one beat me, all this thing, is so unacceptable, and we have to name it and then stop it and figure out and give the tools to all of us, so that we don't perpetuate the things we don't want in our world. Hard to do when the President of the United States stands accused by so many women, and there he is. He got elected. Melinda Myers, Dr. Myers, we have 6 minutes left. No, five.
Wow. Sharon, you know, these conversations are so difficult, and I'm grateful to the opportunity to be able to have it with you in this place, you know, with lots of other people who are listening and nodding their heads as well.
Yeah.
And I think that us talking about it is helpful. You know, not the silence, like our first caller, the experience that she had of being required to keep silent.
Yeah.
That's over.
Yeah.
And I think that all of that is going to encourage people to really take a look at, like Lorna said, their impact versus their intent.
Yeah.
And to really pay attention to how it is that we treat one another.
Yeah. And I would say, if you're out there and you're a man, or if you're a woman, and you happen to, let me just say, slight somebody. I'm not talking rape or something violent, but you've slighted someone, and you know in your mind and your heart that what you did was not kosher. For me, an apology would make such a difference in my life. If you would have said to me, "I am so sorry what I did to you when you were 10 years old, or when you were 23, when I said that, or when I put my hand where I shouldn't have, I never forgot that I did that to you, and now I want to make amends, and this is what I've learned since then," you know, because we do grow and learn. And you know, I've been having this conversation. Well, is there stuff in your past, you don't have to tell me what it is, that you did that you now know was wrong, but you didn't know it then? And I'm getting a lot of yeses, and I don't want to know. I don't want to know what you did. It's not important. But if you know what you did and you now know it's not right, make amends. At least that's a place to start.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, we do have time for one quick call. If somebody were to call in right this minute at 826-4805, and that would be pushing it. But if there's somebody out there that just has one more thing they wanted to say, I came way over prepared. There's so many more areas we could have gone into. Charles Blow from the New York Times says this is a man problem. You know, he clearly calls it out for what it is. And, you know, masturbating in front of women is like, that was a whole nother topic I wanted to discuss. Like, what is that about? What is that about? We don't have time now. unless you could in 60 seconds.
I cannot in 60 seconds.
We'll have to do this again. But he says it's dangerous and unbridled male aggression. It's not only a component of male sexuality, it's a prized part of it. That has to change.
It's entitlement, and that's the part that needs to change. Yeah. No one is entitled to the bodies or spirits or minds or love of another human being.
And emotional intelligence. Men need to get some emotional intelligence.
Well, we need to stop training it out of them when we're little.
Yeah.
See, when we teach little boys that the only emotions that they get are anger and humor at other people's expense.
Yep.
And what we need to do is to let them keep that whole emotional palette
Absolutely.
That they have as little boys.
Absolutely. You know, I say a man ain't supposed to cry. A man should cry. Men who don't cry are
dangerous.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Myers, and congratulations on decades of teaching here at Humboldt State, and I wish you well in your next endeavors. I'm pushing for you to get a radio show here on KHSU that deal with these topics on over time and in a regular format, because we need it.
I appreciate that, Sharon. Thank you for those kind words and for all you do for KHSU and our community. And for marginalized people who can't speak up for themselves.
Yeah, it's important that we do. And Michael, thank you for doing the duties here on Thursday Night Talk on the line. And I'll be back next month with I don't know what yet. Thanks. Thanks, everybody, for calling in and for listening.
You've been listening to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Sharon Fennell, and to our guest, Melinda Myers. And thanks so much to all of our calls this evening. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email ThursdayNightTalk@KHSU.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Next week, Eric Kirk is hosting Thursday Night Talk. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next.